to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. A little over 2 years ago, amidst all of the suffering and violence in the Middle East and in northern Iraq in particular, our good friends ISIL or ISIS or the maniacs, whatever you want to call them, moved in on a particular territory, and particularly the town of Sinjar, and moving in forced thousands and thousands of people out of the town and into a nearby mountain. And these people, as many of you know, were the Yazidi, a religious minority, one of many small religious minorities that are in Iraq and the neighboring countries. And it was really quite a striking moment for me and other esotericists, because while most people had never heard of the Yazidi before, some of us have been fascinated by their very unusual religion for quite a long time. And it was an extremely strange experience to see these people that I associate with these very esoteric, ancient, unusual, heretical traditions, something that I study at, in the margins of my interest in Gnosticism and angels and devils and all manner of odd esoterica, suddenly thrust into the middle of contemporary history, of the violence of our moment. And of course, the sympathy for the Yazidi, especially those who were starving on the mountaintop on Mount Sinjar, helped spur the U.S.'s return to Iraq as a field of battle, and it helped turn people even further against the maniacs in ISIL, who has since that time have shown essentially genocidal behavior vis-a-vis the Yazidi, who they particularly hate because of their weird religion. And this is manifested not only as murderous rampages and forced conversions, but also the mass capture and abduction of women and girls who are reduced to sex slavery. Of course, with justification from the ISIL's reading of the Quran. And the Yazidi remain important figures in our understanding and the events that are happening in northern Iraq. Currently, of course, there's a campaign underway to retake Mosul, and there's people who hope that there are some of these women and girls who are still in the city. Others fear that they have been taken out by retreating ISIL forces. So we'll see about that. And just recently, actually, just the other day, a Yazidi woman who managed to escape from the clutches of ISIL won a European Union Sakharov Prize for her work as a civil rights, human rights activist, supporting the Yazidi cause. So with all this going on, I thought it would be a great idea to talk more about the Yazidi, their history, their esoteric ideas, and how the Yazidi have played a role in the Western esoteric imagination among people like me who are interested in magic and the occult, and particularly interested in their amazing deity, Melek Taos, the peacock angel, a fascinating story which we'll hear about, but also wanted to keep up on what's happening with the Yazidi now as they go through this genocidal assault from ISIL. So to help me with this stuff, we're going to be talking with a fellow who speaks and writes about the Yazidi and the Peacock Angel under the name Azi Rasa. He's got another name, but you'll see why he prefers to keep this one under wraps later on. So Welcome to the show, and thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be a guest today.
Yeah, great. Well, since we're talking, a bit more about the current political situation, what is your sense of what's been happening with the Yazidi over these last 2 years, and how is the international community responding to it? Is there any hope on the horizon? How do things look from your understanding?
Well, I think there is hope on the horizon. The Yazidi people, one of the things that's characterized them throughout their history has been a rather extreme insularity, and that is that has deeper roots than simply xenophobia or mistrust of your neighbors or what have you. It's an article of their faith to remain fairly separate from the rest of the world, but in light of the recent atrocities, I think we're seeing more and more Yazidi people realizing that there is such a thing as a sort of a global culture. There is such a thing as a way of making your voice heard, and that the rest of the world, you know, won't sit idly by while these atrocities are happening. So we're seeing more and more Yazidi people reaching out and developing more comfort. You mentioned Nadia Murad recently spoke on behalf of Yazidi women who had been kidnapped and sold into sexual slavery, and for which she received a well-deserved award. In addition to that, Farida Khalaf in July of this year published a book called The Girl Who Escaped ISIS. And that was with the help of another author. And it's about her rather horrifying experiences after being kidnapped in August of 2014 in Sinjar and sold into sexual slavery. It's a very, very difficult book to read. It's the kind of thing where you need Prozac on hand. But it's an incredible story and something that at the very least, folks need to avail themselves of hearing these voices. So I think that the hope comes from more and more comfort seemingly on the part of Yazidi people to make their story heard, make themselves known, dispel centuries of mythology about them, and to reach out for help when they need it.
Well, I'm kind of curious when I think back of August 2014 and the way in which the world community, including the United States, really did sort of respond robustly to their situation. And given how much suffering and how many peoples have suffered attacks and violence at the hands of ISIS and other groups in the Middle East, there's just been so much suffering in Syria, et cetera, that nonetheless there was something special, if you will, about that particular attack and that particular plight and those particular people that did somehow kind of shake up the world community in a way that actually surprised me a little bit, just because it really sort of worked in a way, like the story penetrated people's minds. It felt different. It felt like something that had to happen, that the U.S. had to intervene directly. What do you think was about that particular event that sort of caught people, or what did it have to do with the particular role that the Yazidi have played in that part of the world for so long?
Well, I mean, that's an excellent question. I'm not really sure I have a solid answer. I would speculate that, well, first of all, I was also pleasantly surprised at the response because, you know, there's nothing new about atrocities committed against the Yazidi people and recently as well. I think that the sort of brazen nature of that particular event, the almost immediate news that not only had people been murdered, but women and children have been sold into sexual slavery particularly, I think that resonated particularly with a lot of folks. I think that for whatever reason, we managed to get a lot of photography of the actual retreat on August 4th, the day after Sinjar was attacked. Thousands of Yazidi people retreated into the mountains of Sinjar, and we managed to get quite a few pictures up on social media. So this is one of the times where I'm not really mad at social media.
Yeah, no, I understand that. You know, and of course, one of the reasons for the intensity of ISIL's sort of atrocities against these people is, of course, religion. They claim that they're in their reading of the Quran justifies the kidnapping and rape of non-Muslim women. And, of course, there's a lot of non-Muslims in the area for them to attack. But there's something particularly heinous for them about the Yazidi, which itself is playing off of, as you've already alluded to, centuries of misrepresentation and hatred that has been directed against them because of their peculiar religion. So, you know, I guess in a way, what has been the sort of external negative perception of these people that has led to the kind of hatred and denigration that we see today with ISIS, but which has come to them from other actors for many centuries?
Well, I think there are three major characteristics of the Yazidi people that seem to elicit this kind of response. One is something that's not necessarily unique to them, but shared by other religious minorities in the region, is that they have no written scripture. They are not a people of the book. There have been attempts at some interesting hoaxes that turned out to be closer to the truth than we thought at first, but they have no written scripture. And in that region writ large, lacking a written scripture puts you in a very vulnerable position. For example, in Egypt to this day, Baha'i people, who also have no written scripture, are excluded from a lot of normal civil liberties and rights. They can't marry, for example. So not having a written scripture is used as an excuse to, if not dehumanize, at least illegitimize groups of people. The second thing is, this is somewhat speculative on my part, but the fact is there seems to be a very big deal made specifically about sexual slavery with the Yazidi people. And I don't think it's too much going too far on a limb to say that Yazidi women are probably among the more what in our culture we might call sexually free people. They are less sexually constricted in their culture, and so I would imagine that people who are interested in purchasing sexual slaves would find that tantalizing. Yazidi women don't have the same clothing restrictions as a lot of women in that part of the world, and sexual expression is seen in a very different light in a Yazidi context. But probably the obvious thing is that for centuries now, they have been accused, rightly or wrongly, of being devil worshippers in the most literal sense of the term. And whether or not they're actually devil worshippers is a very, very interesting question, and completely irrelevant, in my opinion, to whether or not they're deserving of basic human rights and dignities.
That's a good point to be made right off the top. We'll talk about their angel in just a moment, but I wanted to make a comment about the question of literacy. You know, it is a really striking thing in the contemporary world to discover, you know, existing long-running religious minorities, communities that are essentially non-literate, meaning that it's not just happenstance, like they just never really got around to literacy, like some indigenous people in the Amazon who just, you know, just wasn't on the table, didn't happen, no big deal. These are people who are surrounded by for millennia by people of the book, and so their absence, the absence of sacred scripture, is a, I don't want to say a conscious thing, but it's something that develops in relationship to these other traditions that are so profoundly literate. And in fact, in historically within Islam, is that the relatively tolerant periods of Islamic rule in both in Europe and in the Middle East were often justified, I mean, meaning tolerant of relatively tolerant of Jews and Christians, was it because Jews and Christians were also people of the book, that even though there was a difference in the religion, and you know, we can see much more extreme versions of conflicts between these faiths today, in other times, the fact that they were all religions of the book, that they all came out of that particular technology, allowed a certain fellow feeling there. But that's something that was not ever going to be extended to the Yazidi, which then makes them also a very kind of magnetic and mysterious community for outsiders, because you can't just go and get the sacred book and read it and go, okay, this is what they think. As you said, there were various sacred books that were published at certain points. We can talk about those, and they were kind of half hoaxes and half reflective of the kind of actual lore that is carried on orally within the group. But of course, this also means there's a great deal of secrecy around what they're actually saying and reporting and doing in the kind of, you know, in the privacy of their own temples, especially given how sort of isolated they preferred to be, at least through most of their history. So there's just a lot of fascination around these people, and there have been for, you know, at least from the Westerners for, you know, well into the 18th century, 19th century. But let's talk about the elephant in the room, the peacock angel, the supposed devil that they worship. Who is this figure, and how do they understand it from within?
Okay. The peacock angel is a title. You'll often see it rendered as Melektaus, Melektaus, which is variously translated both correctly as either the peacock angel or king peacock. Melek, in that family of languages, can both be translated as king or angel. It's a complicated story, and you mentioned that Muslims, Christians, and Jewish people find common ground by being people of the book, but not just people of any book. Those three books obviously draw from the same cultural currency, very obvious in terms of the Christian New Testament and the Jewish Torah and Tikkun, but certainly also, you know, Islamic religious belief draws straight from that sort of Abrahamic tradition. The Yazidis also draw from a lot of the same cultural currency, but have a very, very different perspective on the meanings of these things, and we can maybe talk in more detail later. The peacock angel is identified as the angel Azazel, and that's reflected in their oral traditions. The angel Azazel is regarded as the sort of leader of all the angels and the closest angel to God. And when you read their, you can get them, by the way. We'll talk about the recent publications of some of these oral traditions. When you read through their kuwals, their holy hymns, you get a very clear impression of a very explicitly emanationist kind of philosophy, that these are people who are sort of monists as well as being monotheists, and believe that these different sacred beings in their mythic history are really emanations of what is essentially an ineffable divinity. And Azazel is the closest that we come to the one true ineffable God.
Right. And the kind of key element of him is that his story resembles the story of Lucifer and Satan, in the sense that he is a fallen angel, although exactly the reasons for his falling are unclear. I mean, there's a lot of I know it is complicated because there's a lot of different folkloric motifs and versions of stories that overlap. There's the refusal of the king of the angels to bow down before Adam, who's of course God's creation, and that's a part of Islamic lore, but that feeds into this notion of the kind of prideful angel who falls. What is the kind of sort of clearest way to think about the relationship between this high and holy angel and these other figures that people have recognized as being devils?
Yeah, and that's where, again, the question of whether or not they're devil worshippers becomes complicated, because it is a close relationship. All of these fallen angel archetypes, so-called, overlap with each other. And I think the clearest and oldest literary example of that is Azazel, where we first hear of Azazel in literature in Leviticus, with reference to the so-called scapegoat. But also in pseudo-epigraphia, I can never pronounce that word properly.
Yeah, you did a good job.
we see in First Enoch around 225 BCE, Azazel as being the leader of the angels who descend to earth and have sexual relations with humans, producing the Nephilim. So get your ancient aliens hats on, and that's where we take off from there. But there's no question that these are the same thing. The difference is in interpretation. For Jews and Muslims and Christians, the refusal of an angel, Lucifer or Satan or Azazel or whatever, the refusal of the angel to kneel was a sign of disobedience. For the Yazidi, it's fidelity. It's fidelity to monotheism. And in fact, way back in very deep history, going back, I think sometime around the 8th century CE, if I'm not mistaken, Mansur al-Halaj referred to Azazel as the perfect lover and the greatest monotheist for his refusal to bow before Adam. And there is a sense that this was not hubris, but that this was a test of fidelity. And because Azazel passed that test, God raised him above the rest of the angels and gave him the title of Melech Taus, or sometimes pronounced Tausi.
And then one of the, of course, really intriguing aspects of this figure of Melech Taus, this sort of king angel who rules over the world, and who sort of falls, if you will, gracefully into this plane, is that he's a peacock, or associated with the peacock. I know that this is represented in Yazidi iconography, that there actually is like a holy sculpture or of Melech Taus that's in a peacock shape. But of course, the peacock is not a bird found in northern Iraq. So there's some very interesting things that are going on with this figure of the peacock. Why? How is it maybe even in either in their lore or in their history that this identification formed between this king angel who falls and the animal, the bird, a peacock?
Well, this is where we definitely go off into speculation land, and there isn't a whole lot of good scholarship in this area. You're correct. The peacock is not indigenous to Iraq, and a lot of people have made a big deal out of that. There are certainly some very interesting parallels between Yazidism and some forms of the Vedantic traditions in India. And of course, the peacock is indigenous to northern India and Afghanistan. However, at the same time, there's evidence of peacocks being in the region of northern Iraq and Mesopotamia at least as early as 800 BCE. So they've been there for a long time. They may not be indigenous to that area, but, you know, through trade routes and things like that, clearly people made a big deal out of acquiring peacocks. The interesting thing about the peacock, and what might be a clue to the spiritual connection, is if you've had any experience with peacocks directly. They are absolutely supernaturally beautiful. They are these just unreal, unearthly beautiful creatures, but they're assholes. They're the nastiest, meanest. Can I say that on your podcast?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. They are unbelievably mean and territorial, and so much so that there have been people in history in that area that kept guard peacocks. If you were wealthy enough, because they would make so much noise and run off anybody that wasn't supposed to be there. So you have these phenomenally beautiful creatures that are nasty, violent, and when they're angry, they have an absolutely ear-splitting shriek. And I've always gotten the impression of this sort of archetype of dangerous beauty, of beauty that will hurt you. And recently I've been thinking about the parallels in a sort of modern vampire Dracula kind of mythology, these incredibly beautiful creatures who are unbelievably evil and dangerous.
But I think there's another important element that's true both of the bird and of this archetype, including the kind of vampire, is that there's being mean the way that raccoons can be mean, but the way in which peacocks are mean is extremely haughty. So they have this prideful character, this like they look at you like they're not even going to begin to think about giving you the time of day, and that you should recognize their imperious command. And it's that I think that's the third element. So it's incredible beauty, danger and potential violence, and this kind of pride, this kind of haughtiness that keys in with the pride that the angel had to have, or it's his willingness to not bow down before Adam, to only be the pure monotheist, still required a kind of like, I'm not going to do what I'm expected to do. So there's this figure of pride, which is of course then also becomes part of Satan or Lucifer, where that's part of what the rebellion is that Lucifer's proud, wants control, doesn't want to get in line. So that the animal also has that kind of character of pride, which not all sort of cruel or mean animals have. And I think that's also even true. I never thought about the kind of vampire connection, but I think it's a valid one. And that's true also of the one of the kind of characteristics of at least a lot of vampires, is that they're often from the upper class, they're aristocrats, they have a certain kind of pride, there's a certain kind of aloofness to that figure. It's transcendental as well as chthonic, it's got both poles in it. And it's just so interesting that it somehow manifests actually as the behavior of this amazing animal, with these cries that sound these horrible shrieks, and yet at the right time of the night, in the distance, they're incredibly haunting and beautiful as well. So it's a most remarkable animal.
Yeah, and I agree with you about the sort of regal haughtiness that characterizes. I'm proud to say I was actually chased around the Toronto Zoo for about 10 minutes by an angry peacock. And if it wasn't for the fact that it was so magnificent, and I might have been genuinely afraid and have called for help. But there is that. I also think, and I don't know how much we want to go into this, but there's no question that the Yazidi people have very, very deep pre-Islamic roots in that region. And I wouldn't be the first person to speculate that there may be a connection to widespread cock worship in general, particularly from the Akkadian and Babylonian eras, that seem awfully similar to some Yazidi practices, particularly if you read Layard's description of the Babylonian Yungas and how those bird gods of the storm were treated, and the way their festivals were arranged. It's hauntingly similar to some things that modern Yazidi people do as well. So it may be that the peacock is also just seen as the sort of ultimate expression of this thunderbird sort of archetype that was very popular in Mesopotamian culture.
Yeah, and it's worth noting that the Yazidi themselves claim to be an extraordinarily ancient tradition. That it, you know, some modern scholars asking, you know, where did these guys come from? They'll say, well, maybe it was around the 5th century, blah, blah, blah. You know, something that develops in the medieval period. But the Yazidis themselves say, no, we go way back. And there does seem to be, I mean, when you read the material, and maybe it is because it is, so much of it is still oral. It has a kind of archaic energy that's deeply intelligent, but feels not at all modern. So it's not hard to imagine that aspects of their practices and beliefs, sort of go all the way back. There's also a figure, and I'm trying to remember exactly the context of it, of the sort of notion about the peacock angels. Tears. There's some famous story around the Yazidi. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
You know, I vaguely do, but it's not clicking for me right now.
Well, talk a little bit more about the figure of this angel, and maybe what it was about this figure and how it became of interest to people doing magic and esotericism in the West, people interested in the occult, people interested in actually contacting angels, like this whole sort of underground within the West, sort of cottoned on to the Yazidi at a certain point, and they became a very kind of important source or inspiration for other kinds of speculation. So how did that start coming about? How did the magicians discover the Yazidi?
Well, beginning around the early to mid 1800s, missionary work really took off in that region, particularly Presbyterian missionaries that built schools in northern Iraq. Also in Iran and surrounding areas. And so, you know, a little bit, you got a little bit of whisper in the European news media about these folks. I think that a lot of late 19th century, early 20th century occultists became interested in the Yazidi. One, because, you know, they right from the beginning, it was understood that they had this reputation of being devil worshippers, but also of being mysterious, of having rites and mysteries that they absolutely refused to tell people about, having secrets. And there's nothing like secrets to invite, you know, psychological projection. I think also, you know, the Western magic, esoteric community had been just devouring up Egypt for quite a long time. And there's, you know, as good science and so forth started accumulating more and more information about what these hieroglyphics really meant and what the Egyptians were really doing, they became a little bit less mysterious and a little bit less sexy. And then here come these Yazidi devil worshippers that nobody knows anything about. And wow, there you go. And right from the beginning, also, it was recognized these ancient roots. And so a lot of people, including Crowley, Blavatsky, Seabrook, quite a few prominent names in the occult world at that time, started speculating that the Yazidi were a genuine survival of ancient Sumerian paganism. And this was also in the context of lots of folks at that time having the notion that if you went far back enough, you would find the original religion that we all practiced. And that's where the real secrets were going to be. And the best candidate at that moment would have been Sumer. So I think a lot of the interest in the occult world came from the fact that there was this concept, true or untrue, of a Sumerian connection. There was a lot of mystery. It was really sexy. And there were anthropologists calling these people devil worshippers. So, I mean, that couldn't help but invite interest from people like Yeats and Crowley and Blavatsky and Levi and so forth, who would be looking for just that sort of thing.
And it's true that in both Theosophy, to talk about Blavatsky, and in Thelema, in the religion and lore that Crowley left us, that the peacock angel plays a certain role. I know that in Theosophy, there's this figure of Lord Sanat Kumara, who's this kind of lord of the earth. And there's relationships in the iconography and in the stories to this sort of figure of the kind of prince of the world, who's very regal, but also has these sort of angelic powers. But I know that you've been particularly interested in how Crowley and Thelema have engaged the Yazidi lore and the figure of the peacock angel. How did that kind of come about? That interest come about for you, and what did you start to find as you looked deeper into these connections?
Well, I've been interested in the Yazidi for a very long time. I think I was probably 16 when I saw a reference in a Kenneth Grant book, I believe The Magical Revival, to an unpublished commentary by Crowley that claimed that I was the spiritual source for Thelema, was the secret name of the god of the Yazidis. And I didn't make much of that in particular because, you know, who knows when people talk about allegedly unpublished things. By the way, that turned out to be true. Not that I was is the secret name, but that Crowley did write that. But I thought, okay, here's an interesting group of people I don't know anything about. And I learned some things and I put it all in a shoebox and forgot all about it until August of 2014. And when I saw it was happening with those folks, I thought, well, you know, I'll do what I can, what little I can do. But one of the things I could do is, at the very least, talk to people about this alleged connection between the Yazidi and Thelema. I happen to belong to an organization called Ordo Templi Orientis. I've been a member of the OTO since 1988. I have lots and lots of brothers and sisters in that organization who hadn't heard about this material before. So I went on a bit of a lecture tour, just talking to folks about the Yazidi people, partly in terms of their relationship to Thelema, and partly just in terms of being aware of their ongoing struggles. The Thelemic material on Melek Taouzi and the peacock angel and the Yazidis is very, very subtle, but it's unquestionable. It's there, and there's a fair amount of it that I can't really talk about. But there's no question that Crowley at least played with this idea for a while, that his spiritual source was the same as the spiritual source of the Yazidi spirituality. And given the connections we've already made with fallen angel archetypes, Lucifer, Satan, Azazel, etc., you know, that certainly would have delighted Crowley if he knew that. I don't know if he did or not. I'm not sure how much Crowley really did know about the Yazidi people. In terms of peacock imagery, I mean, that's all over the place in Thelema. I can't believe I missed it until I looked, but it is. And you can refer to Crowley's published works for information on that, particularly book. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I just because I have it open in front of me. I wrote a piece of a kind of a speculative and poetic piece about the peacock angel and the Yazidi for the Strange Attractor Journal about 6 years ago, and the part of the peacock imagery that I found most interesting as being someone who's not in the OTO, so I don't know all the inside handshakes, but Crowley talks about one of his greatest visions, which the Atma Darshana, where he sort of sees he gets like the big mystic download, and he was probably on hashish when he did it, but that's another story. But he calls it the vision of the universal peacock, and there's this great description of this experience, or probably of this experience, that's in his poem Aha. Oh, could I tell thee of the infinite things of light and love? There is the peacock in his fan, innumerable plumes of Pan. Oh, every plume hath countless eyes, crown of created mysteries. Each holds a peacock, like the first. So you get the sense of this kind of fractal unfolding, very psychedelic image.
Absolutely.
Of this sort of eyes within eyes within eyes, and it's all sentient and awake, but it's not. What I love about the image of the peacock and these multiple eyes is that it's simultaneously, in my, one of the ways I interpret it, it's simultaneously a monism, a unity. There's just mm-hmm. the one. There's just the peacock. And yet at the same time, it's absolute multiplicity and variation and perspectives and multiplicity. So it's a very interesting figure, and I think it's incredibly significant in light of the Yazidi material, but also just as a for one's sort of understanding that Crowley uses the peacock to describe his most quote unquote mystical experiences, as a, you know, to contrast them with magic and ceremonial magic and invocation and evocation and all that. His sort of mystical peaks have this relationship to the peacock, which again I think points to, you know, there's all sorts of stuff in Hinduism, and you can go on and on about peacock lore and its role in alchemy, and it's a whole phase in the alchemical process. So of Absolutely. Course we could just do these associations all day long, but it did seem that for Crowley in particular there was something particularly profound about the peacock as an image.
Absolutely. And the passage you're referring to in the poem Aha alludes to an experience Crowley had in 1909 in the North African desert, when he utilized John Dee's John Dee and Edward Kelly. Kelly never gets enough credit for this stuff. Their Enochian system to explore these spiritual spaces, and they do one a day. They have one vision a day. And ultimately covering 30 visions. And one of those visions is the vision of the universal peacock. And so there's a much expanded description in real time of that experience happening to Crowley. And you can read about that in his book, The Vision and the Voice, which is absolutely required reading for anyone interested in Crowley.
Absolutely.
So you're right about that. I mean, he used it to describe this kind of experience where you might say, in one sense, for lack of better language, where a lot of Crowley's system and a lot of his aspirations were to get past duality of thought and into this kind of unity. And the vision of the universal peacock is an example of getting past even that duality of the duality of unity and multiplicity. And it's a really earth-shattering, difficult experience to describe. And I recommend that people get their hands on The Vision, The Voice, and read about that. One of the things that keeps me so fascinated by Crowley, by the way, is when you read his poetry that he wrote for a purpose, or for lack of a better term, under sort of normal conscious conditions, it's hard to find stuff that's good to say about it. But when you read his spiritual poetry, or his words that are inspired or written during these something less than normal states of consciousness, it can be amazing. It can be just unbelievably beautiful and inspiring stuff. And for me, that's at least one piece of evidence to support his system.
Yeah, I mean, I've always said with Crowley, and it's true of a lot of these sort of figures who get slagged from mainstream society, that whatever you think about the magic and whatever you think about the man, that he can be an extraordinary writer, one of the great writers of his era, both in terms of the productivity and the sheer amount of material that he synthesized and covered, but more specifically as a extremely witty, sometimes very beautiful, sometimes very disturbing in a significant, in a philosophical sense as opposed to a blasphemous sense, kind of writer. And so just as a writer, the peaks, the jewels of his oeuvre are really extraordinary. We have about 10 minutes left here, and I'd actually like, since we've mentioned it before, I'd like to turn back and talk a little bit about the Yazidi texts. I know it's a complicated story, but you know, in the late 19th century, there started to be these sort of sacred scriptures of the Yazidi that appeared, which were both hoaxes and not hoaxes, and it's a very complicated story. But can you give us a little sense, like, if people are interested in actually reading some of the choice material that is from the Yazidi tradition, where are the reliable texts? What's worth looking at?
Well, what you're referring to is in 1865, some alleged scriptures of the Yazidi were published, and they were later popularized in 1919 by Isaiah Joseph, a Chicago professor who wrote a book called Devil Worship, the Sacred Books and Traditions of the Yazidi. They turned out to not be that. They turned out to not be scriptures that the Yazidi people wrote or used, but they turned out to have been written by somebody with a great deal of familiarity with Yazidi belief. So they're worth reading. You can find them on the internet if you look under the Book of Revelation and the Black Book. Those are worth reading. They don't get it completely wrong. They just shouldn't be mistaken as legitimate Yazidi scriptures. The best thing to do, there's two books that are a little pricey but worth every penny. One is by Christine Allison, and it's, I believe it's called The Yazidi Oral Tradition. I might be getting that title a little bit jumbled up, but it's by Christine Allison, and it's more secular hymns and songs and things like that, but it gives you a really nice glimpse into some of the Yazidi worldview. The other is a book called God and Sheikh Adi Are Perfect, and these are transcripts of Yazidi sacred hymns. And up until very recent times, you really could not get your hands on these things. And now they are available. They're rather expensive, but worth every penny. And reading through that information, you're going to get a much richer sense, not only of their spirituality, but the way they express that spirituality, than you will certainly by, you know, Google or any of the few books that have been written about them.
I know it's asking a lot, but can you talk a little bit about your having done more reading on and exposure to these deeper dimensions of their life and attitude, a little bit more about their particular spirituality or the way in which they take these ideas that we've been discussing and really bring them into life in a certain way, a certain, you know, what characterizes them, their particular spiritual or religious attitude in contrast to other people even in that region.
Sure, and I'll do that with the caveat that obviously I have my own biases and things that I look for and so forth. But the things that seem pretty obvious to me is that you come away with a sense that, number one, individual gnosis, individual relationship with spirit is the most important thing to the Yazidi people. And they don't have a lot of prescribed prayers or things like that. Their prayers are spontaneous, authentic communication with spirit. Reading the kuwals, the holy hymns, they're rather diverse, and they talk about all kinds of stories and interesting ideas about ethics and things like that. But what the flavor that you get from them is a very sensuous, kind of Sufi-esque relationship with these spiritual beings, especially with Tawzi and with the Akkadian god Shamash. They seem to have a sort of love for these beings that goes a little beyond what most Western people would think of when they think of, you know, agape or love of brothers or love of spirit. There's a real sensuous yearning that you get from some of this stuff, which may go back to these ideas of angels interacting in a physical and sexual way with humans.
Well, that is very very interesting. How much are the Yazidi themselves kind of participating in an opening up of their their faith and their practices today, you know, whether out of expediency of recognizing that they need to share something about them to get more attention or get more support, or because you know, they're, more of them are going to be spending time in exile or going to have to, you know, go to Canada, which just recently, you know, went out of their way to accept Yazidi refugees. So they're going to be having to participate in the, you know, in the same multicultural society that everybody else is doing. But how is that happening? Is there resistance? Is it still something that's a work in progress? What's going on with their willingness to share their once very isolated ways with the world?
Well, of course, being an outsider, it's difficult for me to say. Clearly, there is an opening up of interest in, you know, the Western world. More and more Yazidi people are attending schools and things like that. But there's always been some German folks have demonstrated this for years. There's always been an idea in Yazidi culture of an esoteric side of life and an exoteric side of life. And, you know, over the years, their interactions with outsiders have waxed and waned. And there have been times, especially in the 14th century, when they were rather active with trade and business with other people. And they always kept this kind of idea that there are mysteries that are just for us, and then there are other things we can share with people. Right now, there is a U.S.-based organization called YASDA, which seems to be a very good organization for getting news on the Yazidi, for funneling help for the Yazidi, but you don't see much about them sharing any of this cultural information or spiritual information, and you don't see a whole lot about people directly addressing the epithet of devil worshippers. You see a lot of focus on calling them angel worshipers, but just not even addressing that issue. I don't know. I think it'll be very interesting to see. My family's Native American, and we have a long history that's in some ways kind of similar. We have a strong focus on oral traditions to this day. We keep our own traditions non-written, but we have no problem with people going to school and interacting with the outside world and so forth. You get people afraid of losing tradition that way. You get people afraid of losing the authenticity of who they are. But I think that's inevitable in a situation like this. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, to what extent do they start sharing their beliefs and practices more openly, and to what extent do they have sort of public relations with other people, but try to keep some of this stuff more to themselves.
Yeah, and I just also wanted to mention that YASDA is a really solid place to contribute money if you were trying to help support the Yazidi as they struggle with this extremely difficult time. I mean, it's you know, any time people go off about the trouble with ISIL or and that kind of very crude theological terrorism and mania is you just got to remember that the Yazidi are suffering from that worse than anyone. In the ways that I think even particularly now, as you know, issues around sexual violence with women and you know, the pervasive rape culture of patriarchy and all these things are so present in our lives right now, it's no accident that it's in sexual slavery that they are sort of that ISIL is sort of defining their particular contempt for the rest of us. Meaning, you know, human beings. So anyway, so it's a very valuable people and cause to support in whatever little ways we can. I'm curious for you, as since you've been doing so much studying and really it's really kind of taken off for you. Has this evolved into personal relationships with people, with scholars? Does it continue to expand, or do you kind of maintain a sort of gatekeeper role for people within your own community in terms of talking about the Yazidi?
Well, no, I mean, I'm certainly I'm making connections with other people that are have been studying the Yazidi. There's not a significant Yazidi population where I live, but there's a growing population not far from me in Canada. And as you said, hooray for the Canadian government. They really bent over backwards to make sure that Yazidi refugees would be welcome there.
Please go. Again, what was that for? Like, what was their cause to do? Was it just that some good people recognized that this needed to happen, or
I think it was simple humanitarian consciousness. Well, one thing to keep in mind, and I think that sometimes this happens in our Facebook meme kind of world, where we hear a story, we hear what happened, we think it's all wrapped up and tidy. And yes, we had military intervention that helped a lot of Yazidi get out of the area and get to safety. But there are still thousands of women continuing to live in sexual slavery today. In that region, and there are still people. Just in June of 2016, 19 Yazidi women were placed in metal cages and burnt alive because they refused to voluntarily submit to sexual slavery. So this is still very, very much going on. And I do hope that folks will do something about it. Check out Yazda, learn some things that they can. It's getting more and more recognition in the news media. And recently, they had an attorney appointed for them for trials that will be taking place in The Hague. I can't remember her first name, but she's a Lebanese-British lawyer who will be standing up for Yazidi rights in the World Forum. And I want to thank you, Eric, for using this platform that you have to draw some attention. I love talking about these spooky, esoteric things. You know, I could talk about that stuff all day. We touched on them lightly here. But the really important thing is that these are real people, and they deserve our help, and they deserve basic human rights and dignities. And I hope people help.
Yeah, and I just wanted just to chime in with that I think that people who are interested in esoteric matters have a particular responsibility towards groups of religious minorities, whether there are, you know, indigenous tribes threatened by oil companies in the Amazon, or these very, very fascinating, very, very profound minor religions, small religions that are throughout the Middle East. So, Raza, thank you so much for joining me on Expanding Mind.
No sweat. Thank you very much. I had a blast.
All right, next week we're going to talk to Ganga White. Until then, keep your minds open.